It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me. Have to teach the children about living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching us close, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, December 1st, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola, broadcasting from my office in the Chicago suburbs. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, we are free to discuss controversial topics that are not politically correct and those you might not hear about on other programs. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my three books, The Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book 2 and 3. I also have another book that I am, well, it's at the publishers as we speak. It is called Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. Hopefully it will be out by Christmas. If not, then soon thereafter. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com. All of the more recent audio files of my program are at this site, including the RBN audio files, the American Free Press files. My Twitter account is twitter.com/DeannaSpingola. If you have questions during the program, you may call in at 646-787-1915. We will also be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, spingola.chatingo.com. Today I'm going to talk about, because it is the anniversary of Pearl Harbor coming up in just 7 days, I'm going to talk about some of the things that led up to the assault on Pearl Harbor. And next week, James Perloff will be my guest on this program. And he is also going to be talking about the same thing. Hopefully we will be covering different topics. He's going to focus more on Pearl Harbor. And I'm going to talk about the economic warfare against Japan that precipitated that attack. I'm also going to give you some information from my third book, and the chapter that I'm going to be taking information from is called A Red in the White House. If you're interested in purchasing any of my books, book 2 or 3, actually I've only got one left of book 2 in the soft cover, and I have both paperback and hardcover in book 3. And you can get those from me through my website, which I said was spingola.com. Please excuse my voice. I have been recovering from a nasty cold, and it's just taking a while. So hopefully just ignore my raspy voice. Franklin D. Roosevelt took office on March 4, 1933. Title 12, U.S. Code, Section 95B of March 4, 1933 states, and I quote, "The actions, regulations, rules, licenses, orders, and proclamations heretofore or hereafter taken, promulgated, made, or issued by the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Treasury since March 4, 1933, pursuant to the authority conferred by Section 95A of this title, are approved and confirmed," unquote. This refers to executive orders, which I believe my guest on my RBN program, Clint Richardson mentioned when he was on my program about a week ago. This, as I mentioned, refers to executive orders. Essentially, according to this code, members of Congress are not required to read or vote on bills proposed and expounded by the president, as they are automatically approved and confirmed since 1933. This is applicable to many controversial acts, including Obama's Health Care Act. Members of Congress simply go through the charade of debate and deliberation in order to maintain the illusion that they are actually acting on our behalf. On March 6, 1933, several of the states pledged the faith and credit of their state governments and their citizenry, and I quote, to the aid of the national government, unquote. On March 10th, now remember, this is citizens of the states. In other words, if at any time they need to dip into your savings, they have that right, according to the pledge that was taken and according to those executive orders. Okay, on March 10th, FDR called a bank holiday. On April 5th, the government prohibited the hoarding of gold. On April 20th, it prohibited the exportation of gold by individuals. On May 23rd, Congressman Louis T. McFadden attempted to impeach the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Bank System, the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Treasury Secretary for treason. Members of Congress, who had all sworn an oath, refused to act on his charges. On June 5th, FDR, with Executive Orders 6073, 6102, 6111, and 6260, declared the United States bankrupt. During the Depression of the 1930s, high unemployment existed in America. Isaac Rubinow was particularly concerned about the extent of Jewish unemployment and predicted that Jews, even educated Jews, would only be able to find temporary employment, which would contribute to the growing maladjustment. Furthermore, there would be a small minority in the field of big business, an increasing number employed in the hectic field of salesmanship, an unwilling drift to factory work, and a growing intellectual proletariat without permanent occupational status. And that was a quote. Jews, a minority in America, had a disproportionate number of people leading most of the left-wing groups who embraced the dogma of the Democratic Party. Most Jews enthusiastically supported FDR's New Deal as a solution to the nation's economic ills. They backed the unions, which offered job protection, and began to participate in influential government positions. When FDR took office, according to the Labor Department, there were about 11 million people out of work. He installed radicals, Fabian socialists, Stalin apologists, and communists into his administration, a group called the Brain Trust. In addition to the Soviet communists, both Roosevelt and his wife, Eleanor, were friendly towards the Chinese communists. Harry Hopkins, an FDR advisor, affected significant decisions and various policies. He represented Bernard Baruch and the International Jewish Banking Cartel. From 1937 through May 1944, Hopkins and Baruch were in continuous communication. Whitaker Chambers, a Soviet agent who later defected, claimed that FDR was merely a puppet and that a group of Jews and communists was actually running the country. This group included Baruch, Samuel Rosenman, Raymond Moley, Felix Frankfurter, Henry Morgenthau Sr. and Jr., Harry Dexter White, Alger Hiss, Benjamin J. Cardozo, Charles W. Taussig, Nathan Margold, Charles Wyszynski, Leo Woolman, Rose Snyderman, Isidore Lubin Jr., Saul Rosenblatt, Jerome Frank, Mordecai Ezekiel, Herbert Fies, David E. Lowenthal, Sidney Hillman, Albert Taussig, Alexander Sachs, Maurice Karp, Robert Freshner, Robert Strau, Donald Richberg, Ferdinand Picora, Samuel Untermeyer, James Landis, Samuel Dickstein, Herbert H. Lehman, James P. Warburg, David Stern, Henry Horner, Louis Kirstein, Benjamin V. Cohen, Walter Lippmann, William C. Bullitt, Adolf Burrell, Joseph Proskauer, Nathan Margolin, Abe Fortas, Saul Padover, Albert Arendt, Felix Cohen, and hundreds of other Jews. FDR appointed Harvard Law Professor Felix Frankfurter, born in Vienna, as a Supreme Court Justice. He was also FDR's legal advisor in the creation of national policies. Washington insiders often referred to Frankfurter as the president. He advised FDR on whom to put into various influential government positions. In 1933, Roosevelt gave Rose Snyderman a position on the Labor Advisory Board of the National Recovery Act. Anna Rosenberg was on the board of the National Recovery Administration, as well as on the War Manpower Commission in the Defense Department during the war. Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins named Dorothy Jacobs Belanca to head the Maternal and Child Welfare Committee. In 1936, Eleanor Roosevelt invited Pauline Newman and a delegation of female garment and textile workers to spend a week at the White House. Rosenberg, President Harry S. Truman's Assistant Secretary of Defense, ultimately became a very wealthy public relations professional for corporate America. The United States had severed diplomatic relationships on December 6, 1917, because the Bolsheviks had refused to honor prior debts that the Tsarist government had incurred. Henry Morgenthau and Dean Acheson, both Felix Frankfurter, born Litvinov Finkelstein, to the White House to finalize Soviet recognition with FDR, something the Soviets had sought for 17 years. Litvinov was one of the Bolshevik conspirators who met with Trotsky, Lenin, Stalin, and Kaganovich for a strategy meeting in Switzerland before going into Russia just before the revolution. Acheson, formerly a law clerk for Justice Brandaus, that's Louis Brandaus, was one of Stalin's lawyers even before FDR recognized the Soviets. One of FDR's first official acts was welcoming Litvinov to the White House. FDR, ostensibly from a prominent, wealthy capitalist family, began transforming America into a communist state. He legitimized the Bolsheviks after they had plundered Russia and starved and slaughtered millions of Russians. Litvinov had several strategies for communizing the American hemisphere. And now the Bolsheviks had a president who would gladly cooperate with their objectives. Many patriotic organizations and individuals implored FDR not to develop these allegiances with Moscow. However, he took advice from Marxist posturing as intellectuals, labor union radicals, and university professors. Dean Acheson and Henry Morgenthau, both Felix Frankfurter proteges, convinced FDR, without congressional approval, to sanction the establishment of a Soviet embassy and officially recognize the Soviet government, which he did on November 16, 1933. People credit Acheson, founder of the Atlantic Council, with creating NATO and imposing it on Europe. FDR then appointed Acheson and Morgenthau to study trade opportunities with the Soviets. FDR's advisors, most of them Jews, all advocated communism, and they were close to the international bankers and anxious to destroy Germany. Russian-born Isidor Lubin was a U.S. representative to the U.N. Russian-born Leo Pazbalsky held an influential position in the State Department and was the executive director of the Committee on the Post-War Program. Samuel Rosenman, as special counsel, wrote most of FDR's speeches. Herbert H. Lehman, director of the UN Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, directed funds, mostly from the United States, to Soviet satellite countries as a consequence of the Yalta and Potsdam decisions. Of course, that was after World War II. Lehman had been Roosevelt's lieutenant governor when FDR was governor of New York. Okay, now regarding the economic warfare against Japan. On October 5, 1937, President Franklin D. Roosevelt delivered his quarantine speech in which he referred to the Japanese invasion of China on July 7, 1937, the beginning of a war which would last until September 2, 1945. The president implied that law-abiding countries should quarantine aggressors. When asked by reporters, he denied that he was planning to impose economic sanctions. Yet, on December 7, 1937, following Japan's sinking of a United States gunboat, the Panay, on the Yangtze River, Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr. suggested that Roosevelt use Section 5B of the Trading with the Enemy Act, TWEA, of October 6, 1917, to freeze the dollars that Japan or any other foreign nation, enemy or not, held in the United States. Roosevelt asked Morgenthau how much gold the Japanese government had sequestered in the United States and what they might do to deny Japan the use of its money, not just the gold, but everything that they had in the U.S. Morgenthau perceived that FDR might be open to the idea of an economic assault on Japan, which held about $55 million of liquid assets, not gold, but mostly in dollars in the United States. Now, keep in mind that the Jews declared economic warfare on Germany in the spring of 1933. So here we are four years later. On December 14, 1937, Morgenthau, per FDR's request, asked Herman Oliphant, former president at Johns Hopkins University and now general counsel of the Treasury Department, which office he held from 1934 to 1939, to verify the idea that the United States could seize Japan's assets to compensate for the destruction of the Panay. Of course, one must ask what the Panay, a gunboat, was doing over there to begin with. Now, Morgenthau first met Oliphant at FDR's inauguration and immediately offered him a position in the Farm Credit Administration. Shortly thereafter, he moved to the Treasury job. Oliphant, heading a group of Treasury lawyers, facilitated Roosevelt's legal objectives. Oliphant, in agreement with Professor Jacob Venner, believed that America, Britain, and France should join in a punitive economic assault against the Axis powers. They both endorsed the imposition of duties on imports from Germany and Japan. Now, keep in mind, this is before the war started on September 1st, 1939, in Europe. Oliphant, with two aides, devised a document following Roosevelt's unrestrained power over financial transactions with foreign nations. FDR could simply use the Trading with Enemy Act, the TWEA, which he had applied on his very first day as president in 1933, to suspend the American banking system. Morgenthau prompted Oliphant to come up with the idea of using an emergency proclamation to apply TWEA powers against Japan, which would prohibit Americans from any business dealings with the Japanese government except those that the Treasury licensed after approval by the Federal Reserve. On December 17, 1937, FDR introduced Oliphant's ideas for using the TWEA against Japan by proclaiming an emergency. Morgenthau enthusiastically declared, and I quote, "It's only a matter of 5 or 10 years before we'll have them on our neck." So this was, and that's a quote, unquote. So Roosevelt ridiculed Cordell Hull for believing that sanctions would potentially start a war, whereas simple quarantines would be more benign. Roosevelt did not want to do anything without first obtaining British support. Now, the British and the American government had literally become a partnership back in 1897. But Roosevelt still wanted to make certain that the British supported the quarantine. American financial experts determined that Japan was ill-equipped to sustain a lengthy war, as the nation did not have sufficient hard currency to purchase essential commodities abroad. Harvard-educated Herman Feis, F-E-I-S, who I mentioned before, an economic advisor for international affairs to the Department of State in the Hoover and Roosevelt administrations, was born in New York City and raised on the Lower East Side. His parents, Louis Feis and Louise Waterman Feis, were Jewish immigrants from Alsace, France, who immigrated to America in the late 1800s. Feis, who Whitaker Chambers referred to, wrote, and I quote, "Warfare requires many vital raw materials, which Japan does not possess at all or in sufficient quantities, and which must be purchased with foreign exchange," unquote. Hence the, and I quote, "the ability of Japan to carry on a protracted war depends ultimately upon her actual and potential foreign exchange resources," unquote. Japan had inadequate sources of iron and steel, copper, lead, zinc, and the essential alloying elements for strengthening steel. Japan also had insufficient petroleum and the inability to refine imported crude oil, essential for both the military and the civilian population. Further, Japan imported wool, leather, lumber, chemicals, and food products. Japan also lacked the expertise to construct machine tools for use in building warships, aircraft, and munitions. They imported items such as lathes, grinders, drills, and other essential tools and equipment. Milton Friedman called Professor Irving Fisher, and I quote, "the greatest economist the United States has ever produced," unquote. Fisher attended Yale and was a member of Skull and Bone Society, who, just before the 1929 crash, claimed that the stock market was at, and I quote, "a permanently high plateau," unquote. And, of course, he knew very well that it wasn't. He was a liar. a Fisher referred to Jacob Venner, who I previously referred to as one of the big leaders in the FDR administration. He referred to Venner, son of Jewish Romanian immigrants, as just one of 18 economists who, and I quote, understand the real meaning of money, unquote. Venner, and that's V-I-N-E-R, an expert on economic theory, balance of payments, and international trade, was associated with the early Chicago School of Economics in the 1930s. Venner mentored fellow Harvard PhD Harry Dexter White, who joined the Treasury Department in 1937 when Morgenthau created a position for him in monetary research. White embraced Morgenthau's hostility to both Germany and Japan. Note that if you get one of them in there, that pretty soon you will have the entire State Department filled with people who will go along with whatever economic or state policy that they want. All right, let's just look and see if there are any questions in the chat room. And I don't see any questions. Okay, somebody did ask about book 2 and 3. Book 1 is only available in a PDF file, but you can purchase them, book 1, from Amazon. All righty, back to our economic sanction, economic warfare. This is the sanction is warfare, okay? Sanction just sounds a little bit nicer, but it just means economic warfare, which the United States has used against, well, a lot of countries, and which, of course, England used against Germany in World War One and World War Two, and well, actually in a lot of places. Archie Lockhead, the technical assistant to the secretary and the administrator of a dollar stabilization fund, evaluated the world's markets. Morgenthau, thinking about the use of sanctions, often asked the advice of knowledgeable people outside of the Treasury, such as L. Werner Knoke, K-N-O-K-E, who just happened to be the vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. Well, he asked Knoke about foreign exchange and currencies. Undersecretary of Commerce and Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, Wayne C. Taylor, warned Morgenthau that a financial sanction might instigate a war. Well, no kidding. That was the exact objective. If Herman Oliphant had not died in 1939, he would probably have played a significant role in creating sanctions against Japan. On July 2, 1940, Roosevelt signed the Export Control Act in order to halt Japanese expansion, to avoid the scarcity of essential commodities in a potential pre-war environment, and to limit the exportation of materials to Japan. FDR issued a presidential proclamation forbidding the exporting of aircraft parts, chemicals, and minerals without a license to convince Japan to curtail its occupation of the Indo-Chinese coast. And, of course, that was their excuse. The Export Control Administration, the ECA, would administer the permission process of those firms which the government allowed to continue business dealings within Japan. So they wanted to control exactly what Japan was able to import, and this is just just awful, 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 awful. On January 10th, 1941, top ECA officials, remember that's Export Control Administration, ECA officials had advocated immediate action. Thomas Hughes, H-E-W-E-S, evaluated financial sanctions, including a refusal to buy gold, restriction of financial assets, and other steps. Now, any money that Japan had in the United States, some of it was, of course, in U.S. banks, which were under the control of the Federal Reserve. On March 31st, Hughes, in a meeting with Noel Hall, the visiting British Minister of Economic Warfare, it's amazing that the British had a Minister of Economic Warfare, criticized America's lack of financial weapons and sought to create committees to work on ideas for seizing enemy property. So the British stepped right in to give America some added advice on how to seize enemy property. And of course, up until that point, Japan probably didn't realize that they were the enemy, although they were part of the Axis powers. But keep in mind, the war had been declared. September 1, 1939, the European war started. But there was no warfare up until December 7th between America and Germany or Japan. Okay, they had to get one started. And, of course, the way that they did that was through this economic warfare against Japan. So on January 27th, Ambassador Joseph C. Grew sent a telegram to Secretary of State Cordell Hull reporting the following, and I quote, "The Peruvian minister has informed a member of my staff that he heard from many sources, including a Japanese source, that in the event of trouble breaking out between the United States and Japan, the Japanese intend to make a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor," unquote. Okay, this is January of 1941. Hull was one of the architects of the federal income tax laws, both in 1913 and in 1916, and was instrumental in establishing the United Nations. People refer to him as the father of the UN. He promoted regulated free trade, which people devised in order to stifle free enterprise and destroy national borders. And that's what free trade is all about. And, of course, it culminated many years later in NAFTA, which was promoted by both the Bush administration and the Clinton administrations. Okay, in February, a new Assistant Secretary of State. Now, keep in mind that he's the one that promoted communism. He was Stalin's very first lawyer in this country, even before FDR recognized Russia, the Soviet Union, formally recognized the Soviet Union. So this Assistant Secretary of State encouraged the Treasury to look for additional dollar assets in the United States belonging to Japan. They wanted to take over everything that Japan had placed here in this country. On February 7th, 1941, Wayne C. Taylor, mentioned previously, now an assistant Treasury Secretary, said that given the spending rate in 1940, Japan could finance its war against China another 18 months until 1944 with its assets in the United States. This was despite the embargo. Okay, so they could still continue warfare. And so Acheson, who was a member of Scroll and Key Society at Yale, took office, as I mentioned, as Assistant Secretary of State on February 1, 1941. He immediately favored the idea of freezing the assets of Germany, Italy, and Japan. Acheson spoke with Thomas Hughes, the Assistant Secretary of the Assistant Treasury Secretary, and the head of the ECA. I mean, they have these double positions, and I mean, it's just so amazing how they give one man all of this power to make all of these decisions. And he described his planning division goal. The ECA was full of Harvard-educated analysts. And Hughes tried unsuccessfully to enlist Bernard Bernstein, Morgenthau's assistant general counsel, onto his team. On February 9th, Morgenthau had the full mentioned earlier, and now Acheson, all of whom disagreed with Hull's inflexibility. On that same day, Morgenthau, putting pressure on Roosevelt, intimated to some reporters that the government was soon going to impose a financial freeze on Japan. And this was after they were told that, gosh, if things didn't go well, that Japan was going to attack Pearl Harbor. So they had to really get moving in order to make that happen. Okay, let me just check and see if we have any callers. I think we do have one caller, but I do believe that this individual is just listening in. Perhaps that individual could email me and tell me. It's a 111 number. Just email and tell me whether you had a question or whether you are just listening in. That would be terrific if you could just do that for me. Alrighty. Economic warfare. Hull told the press that a freeze would be ineffective and would incite Germany and Japan against American investments in their countries. Acheson and other State Department officials spoke with Assistant Attorney General Francis M. Shea about devising an acceptable compromise. On February 14th, Hull sent a memo to FDR in which he acknowledged that foreign countries should disclose their assets within the United States. Hull still opposed a general freezing of Axis assets. Morgenthau and some of his colleagues continued to promote a Treasury-administered freeze. Acheson seemed to be supporting another program, which disappointed Morgenthau, who called Attorney General Robert H. Jackson, who was unaware of the entire matter and did not want to get involved with Secretary Hull's ad hoc scheme. Now, Attorney General Robert H. Jackson will play heavily in the Nuremberg trials that I also talk about frequently and have several chapters in Book 3. Shea, suggesting an executive order. Remember what executive orders, they don't have to have approval from Congress. They don't have to have approval from anybody. They just have to have a president saying, okay, this is an executive order, numbers so, so, and so, and that's a done deal. So, Shea, suggesting an executive order, decided to form the Civilian Economic Defense Committee. Isn't that interesting? Economic Defense. Oh, gosh. Which might lead to the reorganization of the ECA. In other words, hey, if the ECA isn't going to do what we want them to do, then we're just going to have to have another committee formed by executive order and call it Civilian Economic Defense Committee that will take care of what we want to do. So, Shea shared a draft two executive orders with Bernard Bernstein, an assistant general counsel of the Treasury and a former student of Herman Oliphant at Columbia Law School. Notice all these allegiances and alliances and former cronies and how they all just seem to work together, and they were just all cronies and buddies and just, you know, just taking care to make sure that these executive orders were legitimized through various committees so that Congress would be left completely and totally out of the picture. All right. So in November, now getting backtracking just a bit, just to give you a little bit of information about Bernstein and Oliphant. In November 1933, and that was after FDR took office, Bernstein heard that Undersecretary of the Treasury Morgenthau had selected Herman Oliphant as his general counsel. Oliphant had been his general counsel at the Farm Credit Administration. So, in December, Bernstein is the one that wrote to Oliphant about a job at the Treasury. See, all this cronyism and the people in charge, the people who had connections and ties to the Treasury and to the State Department, made certain that they got their people, the people who they knew in previous, like the Farm Credit Administration, that they jumped these people into the Treasury because they know how they'll operate. They'll be obligated to follow the directives and to make the right decisions. So one of the drafts would award the Treasury control of all exports to the Axis nations subject to State Department veto. Forget Congress, forget, you know, they're just a bunch, you know, 535 people who just, they march to the tune of the executive orders. They march to the tune of, well, the president. And the president, as we know, is the CEO of the United States Corporation. So, the State Department and the Treasury Department would take over, and they would put sanctions on Japan. Acheson's draft indicated that the State Department would head the ECA, giving Acheson complete control over the ECA. And that's exactly what they wanted. Acheson arranged a Treasury State Conference in his office for the very next day. On February 17th, 1941, let me just check my email, see if I have any email. Check for new email. Remember, if you want to make a comment or ask a question, the email is comment@spingola.com. Alrighty, I don't have any email, so I'm not sure whether my listener is listening. Let me just check and see if there's a question from our listener at 111. Let me just bring them live here. Yes, the 111. Did you have a question or comment? Or are you just listening?
I just emailed you.
Okay.
I did have a kind of sort of a comment question.
Okay.
You know, back when I was a kid, maybe I was probably 9 or 10 years old, and you know, my dad, after World War II, my dad paid for these four Czechoslovakian guys to come to the U.S. You know, he, like, sponsored them, or I don't really understand it. He called them deportees, and he, you know, was for them to escape communism.
You're right.
My dad was an anti-communist, and anyway,
as
we were
many
sitting
people
around.
Are.
Yeah, well, I mean, anyway, he's also anti-Jewish. Anyway, we were sitting around in the living room talking. I was talking with this, I called these guys my uncles. They weren't really these guys that my dad had brought over.
Okay.
And I asked
quickly get to your question.
Well, I was starting out with a comment.
Okay.
This is a comment rather than a question.
Okay.
We were sitting around the living room, and I made a reference to communists. I was probably 9 or 10 at the time. And my Uncle Frank said, "Don't you know who the communists are?" He said, "It's the Jew." He said, even the Uncle Frank was educated, but he said this, even the uneducated cabinet maker knows that.
Right.
Anyway, that's how I kind of first made the connection. You were talking about all of the Jews in the FDR administration.
Right.
And the connections that they had.
Okay. Now, do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time figuring out how Japan, I'm trying to picture,
Let me get back to my stuff, and you'll find out. Okay?
You're going to go back to reading your book?
No, it's not in a book.
What is it that you're reading?
It's something that I wrote. So I'm going to I'm going to put you on hold again. Okay. All righty. So, anyway, Acheson got exactly what he wanted. He called for a Treasury State Conference in his office for the very next day. And on February 17th, 1941, Edward H. Foley, White, Bernstein, and John W. Pehle, P-E-H-L-E, a Morgenthau aide, met with Acheson to instruct him on asset control. Now, these are communists and Jews right here, okay? And they're going to tell him how to seize control of another country's assets. They dismissed Hull's idea of targeting individuals and companies. The only viable option was the freezing of whole countries. Burrell expressed the idea that the State Department was willing to sanction Europe, not Japan. Acheson, now a key participant, embraced the concept that the road to power ran through financial warfare, not mere export controls. Foley and Pehle talked with Norman Davis, who Hull respected, and told him that Acheson would work amicably with the Treasury, which was the whole point of putting all of that control within the Treasury and the State Department, with the Treasury making most of the decisions. On February 26, 1941, Roosevelt sent... Well, let me pause here. Keep in mind, in answer to what Russ asked me, he said he didn't understand how the Jews in the administration and the Jews coming from Russia and how this all had to do with Japan. Okay, Japan and Germany were allies. And so if the United States could provoke Japan to start a war, then that would bring the United States into a war, not only with Japan, but with Germany. And that is something that Britain wanted. They wanted, and of course the Jews, wanted to involve the United States yet again in another world war against Germany. But Roosevelt, the United States had no legitimate reason, no cause to fight a war against Germany. There had to be a reason. And so it was a backdoor kind of a reason, justification, get involved with a war against Japan, make Japan seem like the bad guy. Just provoke and provoke and provoke, sanction them, seize their assets. They have, you know, a lot of assets in the United States. Put sanctions against them so they could not import stuff that they needed for, I mean, like food, essential things that Japan had always imported. If they could do that, then they could provoke Japan to take some sort of action, which is exactly what the FDR administration wanted. Okay. So, on February 26, 1941, Roosevelt sent a memo to Hull, Morgenthau, and Jackson emphasizing the critical need to control foreign assets. He asked that a committee composed of the heads of three departments, the Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, and the Attorney General, to approve of any actions that the Treasury would take. He wanted someone in the Treasury staff to function as the Secretary of the Committee, with the State Department retaining the final veto. Meanwhile, Acheson and others in the Treasury were maneuvering the Lend-Lease program for the Soviet Union. Now, Lend-Lease is something that I cover in Book 3, which essentially saved the Soviet Union and allowed the Soviet Union plus other countries to fight a war against Germany, a war that they could not finance on their own. Oh, my gosh. The stuff that the United States taxpayer paid for and did and then sent military people into what was supposedly the greatest war, the justifiable war. Oh, what a rip. World, oh gosh. It is amazing, amazing, the things that occurred behind the scenes that Americans do not know anything about. And yet they think of World War II as justifiable when they know absolutely nothing that was going on behind the curtain, that it was the Jews who did this, starting the minute that FDR took office. Absolute, oh, terrible stuff. Anyway, meanwhile, Acheson and others in the Treasury were maneuvering the Lend-Lease program for the Soviet Union. In April, Acheson, who approached Morgenthau to promote an all-out financial war against Japan. And that is a quote, an all-out financial war against Japan. The ECA officials, which had all been replaced, were also clamoring for financial warfare against Japan instead of just trade embargoes. Even the non-strategic exports and imports from Japan, the same darn thing that they did in 1933 to Germany, they were now going to do to Japan. And it's because they replaced all the officials at the ECA and set it all up so that they would all vote or agree to doing what the administration, the president, wanted done. Hughes thought that a Treasury expert should direct all financial investigations. However, Morgenthau was still uncomfortable relinquishing that much authority to novices. Hughes wanted the most aggressive methods of economic warfare. The U.S. State Department, the entity responsible for foreign affairs, in conjunction with the knowledge provided by the Treasury Department, begin using its powerful financial weapons. The Treasury Department held the authority to control funds under the Trading with the Enemy Act when the president invoked it way back when he first came into office. by January. See, this started when he came into office. It just took a few years to get everything in place to do this. If he could have done it in 1933, at the very same time that the Jews invoked warfare, economic warfare against Germany, he would have done it then. But he didn't have all the people in place. There were people in this country who still thought it was free country, and that there were that there was a choice. So it took 8 years to get things in place. By January, March 1941, during the joint staff conferences in Washington, along with the Singapore Agreement of April 21st through 27th, with the British, remember, he wanted the British to back him, which of course they did, Roosevelt had persuaded American officials to wage a naval war against Japan if she so much as even crossed a particular point in the Pacific without a threat or an attack to any American ship or area. In other words, if they just crossed this particular line in the Pacific Ocean, they didn't even need to act like they were going to attack. They just needed to come into a particular area. Roosevelt, encouraged by a highly biased and communist-stacked State Department, deployed the Pacific Fleet from San Diego to Pearl Harbor, contrary to the Council of Admirals Harold R. Stark and James O. Richardson, who, beginning in January 1940, as the Commander-in-Chief, United States Pacific Fleet, and the Navy's authority on Pacific naval warfare and Japanese strategy. When told to deploy the fleet to Pearl Harbor, certainly a potential target of a Japanese assault, he refused to comply. Because if you take your best fleet, the best of your fleet, and put it where you think the only place in the Pacific that the Japanese would attack, that's really stupid. So he just absolutely, Richardson, refused to comply. So Roosevelt overruled him, and he either resigned or the government relieved him of his command in February 1941. Remember, you have to have officers in place that will be obedient to what you're trying to do, even if it's totally against everything that is reasonable and justifiable. And that is exactly what they did as soon as he came into office. Let me just check my email here momentarily here. All righty. Okay. Thank you, Kent. I always appreciate hearing from you. He sent me an email. So anyway, on March 21st, 1941, Taylor revised Japan's financial data inasmuch as Japan had halted its sale of gold. The Treasury had purchased 6.1 million in January and none since then, as compared to 48.4 million in the first quarter of 1940. In other words, the United States had always purchased, they had a deal with Japan. All of a sudden, it just stopped doing the deal and stopped trading, stopped purchasing, stopped having any communication, interaction with Japan. Cold turkey. At the beginning of March, Japan had $103 million in the United States, a 35% difference from the $160 million in January through March of 1940. On April 3rd, Harry Dexter White told Morgenthau that this reduction was a calculated Japanese strategy. Japan continued to purchase oil from American firms. White persuaded, remember he's a communist infiltrator, White persuaded Roosevelt to freeze all Japanese assets. On July 26, 1941, FDR, according to what White had urged him to do, froze all Japanese assets in the United States and closed the Panama Canal to all of that nation's shipping. In other words, they couldn't go anywhere in the Pacific Ocean. They couldn't receive anything through the Panama Canal. They were just kind of out of luck. Between November 27th and December 6th, the State, War, and Navy departments received several warnings about Japanese intentions, including specific details like the exact hour and date of the attack. American military commanders in the Philippines, General Douglas MacArthur and Admiral Thomas Hart, were part of the network that received decoded messages. American codebreakers had broken Japan's code using a device called magic. Operators could read messages sent to Japanese diplomats worldwide. The United States sent decoding machines to London, Singapore, and the Philippines, but not to Pearl Harbor. Unfortunately, General Walter Short and Admiral Husband E. Kimmel in Hawaii were not part of the network. Oh, gosh, this is so traitorous. Admiral Kimmel told Colonel Curtis B. Dahl, and I quote, "I found out later that the Japanese task force approaching Pearl Harbor had specific orders that if the American forces at Pearl Harbor became alerted before the attack was launched, their task force was to return at once to Japanese waters without attacking." Okay? In other words, the military leaders at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii were to find out about the task force approaching Pearl Harbor, that they would have returned to Japanese waters without attacking. So, of course, the U.S. government, FDR, and his cronies did not supply the decoder machines to Pearl Harbor. They just thought it'd be a surprise. Henry L. Stimson, who was also a member of Skull and Bones and a Standard Oil attorney and influential member of the ruling elite for decades, was Secretary of State from 1911 through 1913 under William Howard Taft, who was also Skull and Bones, and Herbert Hoover from 1929 to 1933, and he just happened to be Roosevelt's War Secretary from 1940 through 1945. Again, the cronyism, putting the right people in the right political offices so that they would make the right political decisions. After meeting with Roosevelt on October 16, 1941, Stimson wrote in his diary, and I quote, "We face the delicate question of the diplomatic fencing to be done so as to be sure Japan is put into the wrong and makes the first bad move, overt move," unquote. So that's the deal. They had to make it so that Japan would look bad. And that's what they did. And, of course, ever since then, when December 7th comes around, you know, the day that we'll live in infamy, yes. But the provocation came from the State Department, the Treasury Department, and their cronies. On November 25th, after another meeting with Roosevelt, Stimson recorded in his diary, and I quote, "The question was how we should maneuver them, meaning the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. It was a difficult proposition," unquote. On November 15th, 3 weeks before Pearl Harbor, General George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, swore a group of reporters to secrecy and told them, and I quote, "We are preparing for an offensive war against Japan, whereas the Japs believe we are preparing only to defend the Philippines. We have 35 flying fortresses already there in the Philippines, the largest concentration anywhere in the world. 20 more will be added next month, and 60 more in January. If war with the Japanese does come, we'll fight mercilessly. Flying fortresses will be dispatched immediately to set the paper cities of Japan on fire. There won't be any hesitation about bombing civilians. It will be all out," unquote. Oh, gosh. Marshall later received the Nobel Peace Prize for his European Recovery Program, the Marshall Plan, which redistributed American wealth to well-connected corporations to rebuild Europe after the British and the United States bombed it into smithereens. I talk about the Marshall Plan in book 3. Oh my gosh, this makes me so irritated, this enraged, it just absolutely enraged. On November 25th, another meeting with Roosevelt, Stimson recorded in his diary, and I quote, "The question was how we should maneuver them, the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. It was a difficult proposition," which I already mentioned. I already quoted this. On that same day, Roosevelt met with Secretary of State Cordell Hull, War Secretary Stimson, Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, General Marshall, and Admiral Stark. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss how to provoke Japan to take the first shot. Without the approval or knowledge of Congress, and most certainly against every constitutional principle, they devised the war ultimatum, a list of 10 demands made to the government of Japan. The next day, Secretary Hull delivered Roosevelt's ultimatum to the Japanese ambassador, Kishibaro Nomura, at the State Department. Hull knew that the Japanese would never accept the ultimatum. Historian Charles Tansil wrote, and I quote, "The Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor fulfilled the fondest hopes of the Roosevelt cabinet. It was easy now to denounce Japanese perfidy and to exult in the fact that the shock of the tragedy had erased all divisions of opinion in America. And Tansel is the gentleman that wrote Backdoor to War, the Roosevelt Foreign Policy, 1933 to 1941, and that was published in 1952. Very good book if you have need for background information. All righty. On December 4th, the government informed the public about strategies developed by the Air War Plans, and this was AWPD-1, a division through the American, it was a division, for Air War Plans, and they announced it in the American newspapers. They created the AWPD-1 with European military industrial targets in mind. See, they were getting all ready for war against Europe. They weren't getting ready immediately for war against Japan, but they had to get themselves all ready for European warfare. However, certain air war conspirators were already promoting incendiary attacks against Japan. Roosevelt, an honorary Pilgrim Society member, and Winston Churchill, also a Pilgrims member and a Rothschild minion, had already made commitments to fight against Germany. And this was before the attack. They'd already made the commitments. And I've talked elsewhere about the Pilgrim Society. I believe in my second or third book I talk about Pilgrim Society. Robert B. Stinnett spent 17 years researching Japan's Pearl Harbor attack, all substantiated by official documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. He wrote that there were, in 1941, 22 Pacific Rim radio intercept stations, including 4 cryptographic centers, especially set up to decode Japanese diplomatic and military communications. The Netherlands government was in exile in London right after the beginning of the war, and that's the war in Europe. The communications network extended from America's west coast to China's east coast, and from Dutch Harbor, Alaska, to Batavia, located on the island of Java in the Dutch East Indies. The United States supervised at least 15 of the monitoring stations. Prior to Pearl Harbor, Tokyo sent daily bomb plots cabled from its Honolulu consulate to the attack fleet using JN-25 radio messages, a very old code. Roosevelt also received those messages. And see, the Japanese government had absolutely no idea that their messages were being read by the American government. Yet the U.S. government still refuses to release any of those JN-25 messages because it would reveal that both Roosevelt and Churchill monitored the Japanese attack fleet all the way to Pearl Harbor. Now, according to testimony at the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, Hirohito, dressed in full military uniform, also monitored all radio transmissions from Admiral Yamamoto's flagship during the night of December 7th through the 8th, 1941. So Hirohito was, of course, keeping in touch with his admiral, the flagship. And after the war, Japanese officials portray Hirohito as a peace lover who they kept completely ignorant of all warfare decisions and activities. Feigning ignorance or incompetence are oft used political ploys. Britain and the United States declared war on Japan on December 8th, 24 hours after Japan's Pearl Harbor attack. Now, the United States government treated Japan totally different than they treated Germany, which I also cover in book three. Not so much talking about Japan. Actually, Japan, a lot of the information that I'm giving you would have been in book three, but then book three would have been twice as big as it is. And so this is just information I've got. I've got enough for another book on warfare in Japan and the Philippines during World War II. Anyway, that's maybe my next book for next year. I don't know. Anyway, so Britain and the United States declared war in Japan on December 8th, 24 hours after Japan's Pearl Harbor attack. Predictably, Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor impacted the United States Pacific Fleet of 19 warships, which the Japanese either sank or severely damaged. Additionally, 340 naval and army aircraft were either destroyed or critically disabled. Now, how would the American public act with all of that destruction? They would be ready to go to war against anybody that the U.S. government targeted. Anybody. Okay? And so Roosevelt had sent all of the newer ships previously stationed at Pearl Harbor to the Atlantic, possibly in preparation for warfare. No. For preparation for warfare in Germany, Japan's ally. So, but the U.S. population didn't know. You know, we're talking 19 warships, 340 naval ships and aircraft. What they didn't know was that most of the ships that Japan sank were from World War I. And in his testimony before Congress, Admiral Block said, and I quote, "The Japanese only destroyed a lot of old hardware. In a sense, they did us a favor," unquote. Our war declaration against Japan was an automatic war declaration against Germany, the ultimate goal of Pearl Harbor. So, the reason that the United States government went after Japan, targeted them for economic warfare, was so that they could join the war in Europe. And they set up technologically and logistically the right number of warships and everything so that the public would be outraged over this destruction, not knowing that, gosh, they were just a bunch of old things. And then, of course, if you sink something like that to the bottom of the harbor, you don't have to really take care of it. You know, blame the Japanese. You know, they're the ones that did all of this. Just blame somebody else. And then whatever the consequences of that of the attack, and you can apply this to 9/11. You can apply it to all of the asbestos and all of the the contaminated air in New York. Well, gosh, the EPA and the New York City, Manhattan regulations would never have allowed for any kind of demolition, although I don't believe it was a demolition, but they never would have allowed for anything. But if you blame it on somebody else, then you kill a few birds with one stone, which is the very same darn thing that U.S. government did with Pearl Harbor. Okay, you need to get rid of a bunch of old warships. Let's get rid of all this old stuff. And so you just have somebody else do it, get rid of all this stuff, and blame them, and then use it as justification to start a war, an unjustifiable war against people who were really provoked. And when you look at the process of sanctions, how they use sanctions against Japan. And sanctions, as I mentioned, has always been part of economic warfare. And it doesn't matter who they're using sanctions against, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Iran. It's warfare. It's economic warfare. They just don't call it warfare. They say, oh, it's sanctions to keep them from doing something terrible. Well, sanctions is something terrible. It's called starving the civilian population of another country. Okay? So, on December 8th, 1941, Japanese Ambassador Oshima approached German Foreign Minister Ribbentrop to acquire a formal declaration of war against America. However, Germany was not under any obligation to make such a declaration, inasmuch as Japan was the aggressor. See, even Germany was under the impression, hey, we can't do this because, look, you're the ones that attacked. So Germany certainly did not need or want to engage in a war with the United States. Hitler figured that it was just a matter of time before the United States would declare war on Germany, as the U.S. Navy had already attacked German U-boats, yes, indeed, for at least a year. Further, Roosevelt abandoned U.S. neutrality and had been conspiring with Churchill since 1936. Hitler assumed that Japan was strong enough to defeat America. Thereafter, he thought that Japan would help Germany to fight the Bolsheviks. Thus, on December 11th, the German Chargé d'Affaires in Washington handed the U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull a copy of the Declaration of War. Hitler defended the declaration before the Reichstag, saying that Roosevelt's failed Jewish New Deal was the real cause of the war, which would conceal the collapse of his economic agenda. Hitler said, and I quote, "First he incites war, then falsifies the causes, then odiously wraps himself in a cloak of Christian hypocrisy, and slowly but surely leads mankind to war," unquote. In order to immediately assign guilt to the Japanese and dispel any suspicion from his administration, Roosevelt initiated an investigation. Oh, this is so, I cannot stand this son of a gun. On December 18th, and when people say that FDR was such a great president, and when you look at what he did to this country, he drastically altered the entire structure of the government, which I also talk about in Book 3. It just makes me sick when people refer to him as such a great president. All right, on December 18th, he issued an executive order, again, that executive order, creating a commission to investigate any U.S. Army and Navy personnel who might be guilty of dereliction of duty. That son of a gun. Yet the commission was restricted and could not consider elected officials who supervise the military. There, I can't think of, he is a real bastard. Excuse my language, but he deserves to just burn where he is. Okay. When I get mad, I get really emotional. So, the commission could only go after the military, but not the elected officers who supervise them. Stimson chose three of the five commission officers. Now, remember that Stimson was compromised. He was as dirty as they come. All these people were dirty. Stacked commissions typically exonerate the guilty and blame others who are either dead or completely maligned. The public, either naive or ignorant, accept commission findings or government versions of any catastrophic event as if the investigation was objective and concise, despite glaring evidence to the contrary. The commission, by design, never considered Roosevelt and his duplicitous, murderous cronies. Stimson chose Owen Josephus Roberts, an associate U.S. Supreme Court justice, to head the commission. Roberts was an interventionalist and an internationalist, like many others, believed that the United States should lead the world in creating an international court, which they would do following the war. He gave a renowned speech, The National Security Constitution in an Age of Globalism. A world court would adjudicate a profusion of humanitarian abuses while building credibility for global governments. Because of the impending election, Roosevelt hoped to avoid a congressional inquiry by appointing his own investigation headed by Roberts. So he immediately went in there and got a commission together. That's what the government does. You get a commission together so that you prevent legitimate, unbiased, independent commissions from actually looking at scientific evidence. You head them off by saying, okay, this is a legitimate commission. So Roberts is heading this commission. Due to those ever-present national security issues, the commission was unable to examine any relevant records regarding Japan's radio intercepts. In other words, they couldn't look at any of the evidence, which would reveal that the government, the U.S. government, knew exactly what was going to happen, because they had already intercepted all of Japan's messages. Okay? And so they had to say, well, gosh, we can't let the commission get a hold of those national security, because of national security, we can't let them see these intercepts. The Navy's intercept operators were not allowed to testify or produce their radio logs, documents, or anything that revealed any of the facts. Roosevelt made certain, and I can kind of relate this to the commission, the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission. Same darn thing. Same exact thing that happened in that commission, and well, every other commission. So, Roosevelt made certain that the commission did not have any information that exposed the commission's part in the entire operations. Officials informed the commission about some of the Japanese intercepted messages before Pearl Harbor, but they did not tell the members about the details of the contents. Therefore, the commission blamed. See, they told them just enough so that they could say, well, you know, those commanders in Hawaii, you know, they kind of knew about this a little bit. They should have been more aware. So the commission blamed General Short and Admiral Kimmel, the commanders in Hawaii, and accused them of dereliction of duties. They accused them of failing to follow defensive procedures and policy. Now, keep in mind that they did not have a decoder there. Further, the commission reported that Admiral Stark and General Marshall acted honorably. Of course, they knew more about what was going on because, well, they attended those meetings about how they were going to provoke Japan. So, of course, they would report that they had acted honorably. Ah, this is just so sickening. Roosevelt reviewed the misleading report prior to its public release. Those who understood actual circumstances, let me just check my email. This just makes me so mad. Let me just check in the... Okay. Back to our chat room, see if there's any chatters that have any questions. Somebody said somebody needs to desecrate his grave. Yes, it's okay to desecrate Hitler's grave and other people's graves if they could in fact find them. But yeah, somebody needs to get a spray can over there. Oh gosh, when I was writing all this stuff, I mean, I just could not believe some of the stuff that I was finding. And now going through it again, you know, I was mad at the time that I had put it together. And yes, it was Hitler's parents' graves that were so desecrated. And going through this again, revitalizes that anger that I felt the first time that I put it together. Those who understood the actual circumstances rejected the commission's findings. Admiral James Richardson, Kimmel's predecessor, said, and I quote, "It is the most unfair, unjust, and deceptively dishonest document ever printed by the government printing office. I cannot conceive of honorable men serving on the commission without greatest regret and deepest feelings of shame," unquote. The public generally accepted the commission's conclusions, just as they accepted the Warren Commission, just as they accepted the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission. They figure, well, okay. And, you know, they really don't even read the commission's reports. They just figure, well, that's the conclusions, that's the consensus of the commission, so it must be true because these people are all experts. They got to see all of the evidence, and so we'll just go ahead and accept it. Baloney. Baloney, baloney, baloney. Yet, like other government commissions, it was a complete whitewash. Government investigations are akin to the mafia investigating criminal activities. General Short had been friends with General Marshall for 40 years. Can you believe that? General Marshall and General Short had been friends. Admiral Kimmel considered his boss, Admiral Stark, as a friend since their Naval Academy days. However, after the successful Pearl Harbor operation, some people received rewards and promotions, while the government ruined the careers of others. So even your friends, Admiral Stark literally stabbed Admiral Kimmel in the back. General Marshall literally stabbed General Short in the back. And for what? Well, Marshall got to be the chair of the Joint Chief of Staff. See, it's all about ego, promotions, money. On December 11th, 1941, Rear Admiral Lee Noyes, the Navy's Director of Communications, imposed a 54-year censorship policy on the pre-attack Japanese military and diplomatic intercepts and any other relevant directives. All records were consigned to Navy vaults. Noyes denied issuing such an order, but later admitted, well, he may have even ordered the destruction of the records, which occurred just a few days before the President's Board of Inquiry. In August 1945, all extant documents were classified as top secret, even to Congress. Even to Congress. Conspirators manipulated the United States into war. They included Standard Oil attorney Henry L. Stimson, an associate of J.P. Morgan & Company, banker Thomas W. Lamont, and a law partner with Elihu Root in a Wall Street firm, the power nucleus of the American establishment, you go from Wall Street to the government. It's that revolving door. First you're a law partner with J.P. Morgan, and then you're the Secretary of War. How clever. War Secretary Stimson, under Roosevelt and Truman, drafted and trained as the War Secretary. He went from Wall Street to being War Secretary, made certain, he didn't do it personally, but War Secretary Stimson, under Roosevelt and Truman, drafted and trained 12 million soldiers and airmen and directed the purchase through well-connected firms of 30% of the nation's industrial output to the battlefield. He was responsible for the internment and subsequent property seizure of thousands of Japanese American citizens, and also German citizens, which I cover in Book 3. So, and these well-connected firms, gosh, I wonder, do you suppose that they were the same firms that did business with him when he was a law partner with J.P. Morgan on Wall Street? I don't know, do you think? Yeah, I bet they were. You know, you go into a country, you bomb it to smithereens, then you go in and you offer them loans through the Marshall Plan. Hey, we'll loan you a bunch of money, but you have to spend it with these particular firms. Oh, gosh. Stimson contrived the economic provocations targeted at Japan to manipulate them into firing the first shot. facilitated by Japan-based Ambassador Joseph Grew and many well-placed members of the Institute of Pacific Relations, who urged Japan's willing war hawk leaders to respond. Okay, so not only were things going on in this country, but there were people in Japan who were saying, hey, don't let those buggers get away with this. You need to target them. You need to go after America. And so you had Japan-based Ambassador Grew, who I mentioned earlier, who urged the war hawks in Japan to respond. Stimson supervised General Leslie R. Groves, who is head of the Manhattan Project, developers of the atomic bomb. Hollister Bundy, who was Skull and Bones, was Stimson's special assistant at the Pentagon for the Manhattan Project. His two sons, William and McGeorge Bundy, both Skull and Bones, followed in their father's global government footprints. Later, Stimson, a significant influence on President Harry S. Truman, personally chose Hiroshima and Nagasaki as targets for the atom bombs, a message to the world at the beginning of the Cold War, and an excuse for the massive military buildup to shrink the U.S. Treasury while benefiting corporations associated with the military. Germany, the original target, surrendered before the bombs were ready to use. So obviously they had to use these bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And that was after Japan offered to surrender. But I think that Jim Perloff will fill in a lot of the stuff that I have failed to talk about. So I hope you'll join him next week when I have him on the program, because we cannot talk enough about this. I've often said that history is prologue. It really, really is. You cannot know of what is going on now unless you read history, unless you know the background information about World War. Well, you go back to the Civil War. Go back to Civil War, talk about the First World War, the Second World War, and then you know exactly what the heck is going on now. Okay? So, in 1942, backtracking a bit, the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations members, under the auspices of the Advisory Committee on Post-War Foreign Policy, had collaborated in setting up the United Nations to replace the League of Nations. Cordell Hull assigned Alger Hiss to assemble and this is 1942, okay? Because they know what's going to happen. They know exactly what's going to happen. That they're going to be able to set up that global governing body. So it says State Department CFR. Remember, the State Department is full of Jews. And so this advisory committee on post-war foreign policy had collaborated in setting up the United Nations to replace the League of Nations. Cordell Hull assigned Alger Hiss, a communist, to assemble a group of other CFR members, Council on Foreign Relations members, to draft the UN Charter. This is back in 42. The group was composed of, well, who would you guess? Dean Acheson, Harry Dexter White, Owen Lattimore, Frank Coe, Noel Field, Victor Perlow, and Nathan G. Silvermaster, and others. Those same people that were in the administration who were giving counsel to FDR, and the UN Charter displaced the U.S. Constitution. White, Coe, Perlow, and Silvermaster, and of course Hiss, were all Soviet agents. In October 1944, the Navy and Army Court deliberated possible foreknowledge and culpability surrounding Pearl Harbor between November 27th and December 6th, 1941. Officials in the State, War, and Navy departments received numerous pieces of information giving specific information about imminent Japanese attack. The courts found Washington officials guilty of not acting on information that caused the avoidable slaughter of over 2,400 individuals. When they revealed the verdict, now this was another court, the Navy and Army Court, which was not very well publicized at all. Okay, General George C. Marshall, guilty as charged, offered his resignation, which of course his superiors rejected. Other issues overshadowed the verdict, and the public heard nothing about it. So you can have all the courts and all the, you know, the courts that you want, unless the newspapers report about it, nobody's ever going to know. Marshall asserted under oath that he considered loyalty to his chief, in other words, FDR, more imperative than loyalty to his country. Later, using the excuse of ill health, Marshall refused to appear before the Joint Congressional Committee that investigated the tragedy of Pearl Harbor. Congress ordered Stimson to open another investigation on Pearl Harbor. In 1944, he chose Christian Clausen, a 33rd degree Freemason, an attorney, and a former assistant U.S. attorney from San Francisco, to conduct a thorough, objective investigation. He interviewed dozens of people and submitted his report on September 14, 1945. He ultimately wrote a book about the investigation just before his death. When Clausen called on Harry Truman, he found him somewhat uncooperative and even unfriendly until Clausen told him, and I quote, "When you were the Grand Master of the Masons in Missouri, I was Grand Orator of the Masonic Grand Lodge of California," unquote. Truman immediately bounded from his chair and began enthusiastically shaking Clausen's hand. Truman said, and I quote, "You'll have my complete cooperation, Henry." Roosevelt said to the U.S. Congress a month after Pearl Harbor, there never can be successful compromise between good and evil. Only total victory can reward the champions of tolerance and decency and faith," unquote. Ah, yikes. Oh, yikes. April 1995. Doggone. The Kimmel and Short families asked Congress to conduct an investigation as they wanted to clear the reputations of the two men who the original commission had accused of negligence and therefore were responsible for 2,402 Americans' deaths and 1,282 wounded at Pearl Harbor. I mean, they got the blame for that. Congress conceded and conducted a one-day show hearing and opted to accept the earlier findings. Darn. Congress arbitrarily decided that Marshall, Roosevelt, and other officials did not withhold critical information from Admiral Kimmel or General Short. The Pentagon also conducted an investigation for 7 months under the direction of Edward Dorn, the Undersecretary of Defense, who issued a 50-page report on December 1st. 1995, rejecting the petitions of the Kimmel and Short families. Dorn agreed with the earlier conclusions. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Well, in we've got about 10 minutes. Let me just check the see if there's any. We'll take some calls. If you want to call in, make comments, feel free to do so. That number is 646-787-1915. So we have all these commissions. They all pretty. The one commission that really reveals some truth was not covered at all by the press. So people are going to accept the conclusions of the commissions that the press reveals, and we see the very, very same situation with regard to all other commissions that we know about. Certainly, the commissions that I talk about in my upcoming book on Sandy Hook, it's pretty sad stuff that when there's a consensus of evil, that they are going to go along and repudiate, vilify the people who really attempt to do the right thing, and absolutely ennoblize the rascals, the filth, the people who are supposed to be representing America. The Congress does not represent Americans. The Congress has actually probably never represented Americans. They have always represented, since the Civil War, the corporations. Corporatocracy took a position in America after the so-called Civil War, which was also a trumped-up war designed to give more power to Washington, which it certainly did. Okay, if you want to call in, the telephone number is 646-787-1915. I can't believe my voice has lasted this long. I took some of my special cayenne cough syrup. Would you believe cayenne cough syrup? It's only got a little bit of cayenne in it, but boy, it is so incredibly effective. I wish I'd written down the recipe. I would share it in the chat room. Let me check the chat room. And, okay, somebody said Congress represents their campaign donors. Absolutely, absolutely. And all of the ABC agencies, whether we're talking about the FDA, whatever agency we are talking about, CIA, all of those organizations represent corporations. I'm just backing up here in the chat room and see what is. Okay. Yeah, Pearl Harbor. We should say that Pearl Harbor was an operation for sure. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. And you know, we would all get in such trouble for doing any vandalism. And I wouldn't recommend that we do any vandalism. I believe in being lawful citizens and all. Anyway, let me just check back. There's a caller from 707. All righty, 707. Welcome.
Hello, Deanna. This is James.
Hi, James.
I just want to say, I never heard such genuine. You, I know you lost your voice, but you were so genuine speaking about that president. I won't mention his name. I have been spending so many years of my life thanking him for the Social Security and all these benefits, and I realize that's how these people stay in control. They throw a little pittance to the people because, oh, Roosevelt, he's the greatest. But the things you pointed to involve the loss of life, the deliberate sacrificing of lives. How do you compare one and the other?
Indeed.
It was the economy, stupid, and the Americans go along with the idea that the economy is all that matters. God forbid you should pay taxes for anything.
Sure. Yeah. There are a lot of, excuse me, in my third book, I talk a lot about FDR. I've got lots and lots of chapters about him. And some of the information I gave today was from FDR, a red in the White House. And that is exactly what he was. He was a red in the White House. And
he showed what he was in 1944. He agreed to dump Wallace. Vice President Wallace was dumped. There was no reason to dump Wallace. He was the only sane person in the White House.
Exactly. And he filled the State Department with communists. And he set up Pearl Harbor. He set up World War II. I mean, if you really wanted to blame somebody for the deaths of World War II, it would be Churchill and FDR.
Yes.
And yet, it's Japan and Germany that always, always get the blame.
They're the bad guys.
And yet, they didn't do it.
Italy, the bad guys. Yeah.
Yes.
And Mussolini, we really hated him. I remember when I was a child how we really hated the Italian. For some reason, my family at least.
Yeah. And
I knew one Jew.
Go ahead.
I knew one Jew on Long Island named Morris Basick. He's still alive today. He's 92 years old. He was a conscientious objector during the Second World War. And he caught the devil from his people of his religion, by and large. And he made the point that the Hitler and all of that, there's no reason for a Jew or anybody else to pick up a weapon.
Exactly. And I was, in getting ready for this program, I couldn't decide whether to talk about biological weapons like gas or whether to talk about what I talked about today. But in as much as we're going to be noting the anniversary of Pearl Harbor within a week, I thought, well, I'm going to talk about Pearl Harbor. But it is quite amazing that with all of the gas and all of the gas supplies that Germany had during World War II, Hitler, because of all the destruction of the gas and because of his own personal experience, during World War I, absolutely refused to use gas against the enemies in World War II, at Normandy particularly. He refused to use it. It could have changed the whole war. He refused to use gas. And yet he gets accused of using gas against the Jews.
Yeah, well, he gassed all these 6 million Jews, right?
Yeah, but he refused to use gas. And when I'm going to give this information at some point in time. But anyway, thank you so much, James, for calling in and for listening to the
program. And I'll pick
today.
Up your third book. I keep putting it off, but thanks for reminding me.
Okay, thank you so much for calling in. Bye-bye.
Sure.
And thank you so much, listeners, for joining me today and putting up with my awful voice. I am getting better. And I will visit with you soon on Sunday on my RBN program. Again, thank you so much. I really appreciate my listeners. Bye-bye.
Starts with you and me.
Starts with you.
Starts with you and me.